Hello, everybody. This is the third installment of Reading with Randos. I can't love that title. We read C.S. Lewis's A Grief Observed. And, well, I guess I can read the last paragraph that we stopped with, which I think was, "Our elders submitted and said, 'Thy will be done.' How often had bitter resentment been stifled through sheer terror and an act of love, yes, in every sense, an act put on to hide the operation? Of course, it's easy enough to say that God seems absent at our greatest need, because he is absent, non-existent. But then why does he seem so present when, to put it quite frankly, we don't ask for him?" I believe that is the one we finished on. And then the next one is, "One thing, however, marriage has done for me. I can never again believe that religion is manufactured out of our unconscious starved desires and is a substitute for sex. For those few years, H and I feasted on love, every mode of it solemn and merry, romantic and realistic, sometimes as dramatic as a thunderstorm, sometimes as comfortable and unemphatic as putting on your soft slippers. No cranny of heart or body remained unsatisfied. If God were a substitute for love, we ought to have lost all interest in him. Who would bother about substitutes when he has the thing itself? But that isn't what happens. We both knew we wanted something besides one another, quite a different kind of something, a quite different kind of want. You might as well say that when lovers have one another, they will never want to read or eat or breathe." My own notes for that is, if you're religious, marriage and relationship might gain a whole dimension because you might feel it has an origin outside the bounds of biology and culture. That's just kind of something that appeared to me as I read that, because it's also something that you do before God, I think. I mean, I didn't marry in church. It's an assumption I'm making. I hope some of you can maybe answer it.
I think it most certainly depends on the couple. You know, there are couples who have their marriage in church, just because it's a part of, I guess, their life, or maybe it's even an expectation of their family. And so there are some couples who, you know, I'm not trying to degrade it with this term, but there are some couples who go through the motions of the religious ceremony. And I know that, you know, we've talked about ritual, maybe on the Discord, maybe on these conversations, and that has its whole other impact. But there are certainly some other couples who, when they're getting married in church, you know, they're very much considering it a union of three, where it's them, it's the couple, and God that is coming into union, and that's what the marriage is celebrating. And you know, I hear echoes of that idea in this passage from the book, where, you know, there is more than, you know, two people, or two presences. Is that the right word? That there's three. And I was doing some research on marriage. I won't say why here in public, but
just between us.
Just between us. Yeah. Nobody else.
And YouTube. Yeah, exactly.
Right. I came across Bishop Barron, talking about marriage, and he referenced a book by Fulton Sheen, who was a bishop. I think it was pretty popular in the 50s and 60s, and maybe even longer in the Catholic circles. And I can't remember the exact title, but it was Three to Make a Marriage, something like that, Three to Marry or something, and how the idea of a Christian marriage, and particularly a Catholic marriage, is not one between two people, and two people should not be getting married in that view, unless, you know, their love of God is greater, and that's what's going to make the marriage. That is a part of the mysterium, mysterium, I can't say it right, the sacrament of marriage, as I understood it to be presented, you know, in from the Catholic perspective. But yeah, just that passage reminded me of all that.
That's interesting. I've been to a lot of weddings. I was, I did professional wedding photography for several years, so I got to experience a wide gamut of different types of weddings. And actually, before I attended, I photographed several Catholic weddings. This was probably 3 or 4 years ago. I had never even stepped foot inside a Catholic church, and I was pretty blown away by the difference that I felt in those weddings at the Catholic church versus even, I mean, there were maybe one or two weddings that were friends and family that I felt like had some depth and meaning to them for sure. But for the most part, I really became disillusioned with even attending weddings and even, you know, photographing them, because I was like, what am I doing this for? These people don't, it doesn't feel like they are, I don't know, that there's anything more than just we're doing this to be socially acceptable. I don't know. But those Catholic weddings, I was just blown away at how deep they felt and how integrated, you know, marriage and family and the church was. And that was a lot of what really pushed me to pursue looking into Catholicism and Orthodoxy. And I mean, there's a lot of things along the way, but they were really powerful, very powerful.
Yeah, I always looked at it as like the importance of God being a part of that that ceremony and that kind of stuff is about elevating the what you're doing into some other sphere other than just two people agreeing to do something and that kind of stuff. If it's just that, like we agreed to do something, just like we're, oh, let's meet at, you know, this restaurant and have dinner and that kind of stuff. It's an agreement that we have. This is something more. And so it's a covenant, and a covenant is made kind of between, if you look at like the Old Testament covenant rituals, I don't know if you ever go back and read the story of God's covenant with Abraham and how weird it is. Yeah. Just story,
the
just it's a bizarre
birds and the walking through the middle and all that stuff.
Yes, exactly. And so like the reason that story, the reason that they're talking about that is because that's actually how covenants in that kind of ancient Jewish culture, that's how they were executed, is that they would take an animal and they would split it kind of nose to tail, and then you would walk between it together with like the covenant that you're making with one another. And what you're essentially symbolically what you're saying is, if I break this covenant with you, let the same happen to me. And so you're actually kind of inviting judgment if you do not follow through on your covenant. And so the covenant that God makes with Abraham, notice that Abraham goes to sleep. Like God kind of puts Abraham to sleep. And then God kind of goes between the animals because God knows that Abraham can't fulfill his side of the covenant. So God's like, I'm just going to do this on my own. I'm going to fulfill this covenant with you by myself, because you're not capable of doing it. It's a very good picture, I think, of the gospel. But that's why I think that having God a part of it, because you're making a covenant with someone. It's not just a contract. It's not just an agreement and that kind of stuff, that while things are comfortable, I'm going to follow through on my side of the bargain. It's a covenant. And without God, without that kind of religious context around it, it just isn't that. It's just an agreement. And I might as well be saying, I'm going to meet you at the bar for beers. And if I just don't show up, oh, well, like, it doesn't matter. Yeah, we'll stay together forever. Or we won't, because I might not feel like it tomorrow. The covenant aspect of it is, I think, why that's important.
I love that story of Abraham. I mean, I always just imagined he was so absolutely exhausted from running and trying to keep the birds away from eating the sacrificial animal, that he just eventually just collapsed, exhausted, covered in whatever, all the blood of all the animals he slaughtered, and then God showed up.
Yeah, or he was on like DMT or something like that.
But also, I mean, Abraham was just, yeah, it shows in that story, like he just doubts, like, okay, maybe if I'll do this ritual, maybe then I'll have certainty. It's, yeah, you just doubt it all the way.
But I think there's something I've been doing a lot of reading about ritual and Drew Johnson's work and how the people of the Old Testament learned, they gained knowledge of God through these acts. And he doesn't, you know, when Abraham says, how will I know? God says, here, well, you know, we're going to go through this ritual. And I think marriage, in a sense, gives you, and I think that, I mean, like the monastics, I think, in a sense, are married to the church. So it's the same type of thing. It's this pledge, this commitment of, you know, I'm not going anywhere. And I think through that, and only through that pledge and that commitment, can we learn and have that knowledge of God. Just that complete, like, I don't know, growing up, divorce was something that my parents very much said, like, you know, it was a serious thing. Like, this isn't a nonchalant deal. Like, if this happens, it's going to be hard and going to be intense. So it was really emphasized to us that, you know, take marriage seriously and try your very best to make it work if possible. And I know it doesn't always work out that way. And I know God can work through that, but I know it's not just like you said, like going to the bar.
Yeah, I can't speak for anybody else's experience with divorce, but, you know, it runs in my family. You know, my two generations, and, you know, I'm the product of a broken family, and I'm the producer of a broken I'm the participant in a broken family, and the fragmentation just resonates, you know, through generations. And I'm hoping, you know, praying that the cycle can be broken with my kids when and if they decide to get married. But I really don't know. You know, it seems so serious to me that there are just things that seem to run through and cause all of this brokenness to just continue to fracture out. You know, I imagine like a piece of glass or a mirror where it just keeps branching and branching down. You know, and I'm reminded of another part in scripture where, you know, the sins of the father will be revisited on, you know, a certain number of generations. I'm probably getting that wrong, but, you know, just the living it is kind of what that feels like. And
my wife also comes from a kind of a broken house. Her mom's been married, I think, four times, maybe five. One of the things that I found interesting, that it would have been the exact opposite if you had asked me before I got married, but if you had asked me, you know, how would the pictures of marriage differ from someone who, whose parents had been divorced and someone who hadn't been divorced? What I found is that my wife had a much more idealized view of marriage than I had, even because her mom, what marriage should be, even though her parents had been divorced, whereas I did not have an idealized view of marriage. I knew that it wasn't going to be easy and that kind of stuff. And so I wonder whether or not, I think that what's going on is, you know, if you see a problem or you're having that kind of conflict and, you know, like C.S. Lewis says, it's turbulent and those kind of things. If you go through that and you're on the other side, and your kids see that, you know, mom and dad are still together, that yes, they were not happy with each other and that kind of stuff, but they made it through. Then you have a more realistic view of marriage in some sense. But if you see that happen and then it breaks off, then you kind of, any problem in a marriage starts to become like an existential, like, this is a wrong marriage. I should get out of this because it's not what marriage should be. And so you kind of have an idealized view in a weird way that I just need to find the right marriage. I just need to find the right person and then everything will be fine and I won't have these kind of conflicts. And so that's what I found with, and Katie and I have talked about it a lot. Actually, I was talking to the guy who actually officiated our wedding, and I was actually talking to his wife, and they had a very similar situation where she had came from a two-parent household and his parents were divorced, and it was a struggle for them too because he had a very idealized view of what marriage should be. And what was interesting here is Lewis is saying, hey, I got the whole gamut, right? I got the good stuff, the bad, the comfortable, like the passionate. I got it all. But there was still something missing. And I think that's important because I do think a lot of times people talk about God as if like we made him up in order to replace something. So in this case, he's talking about marriage, but you could see, okay, you couldn't have kids or you couldn't do all these kind of things. And so we came up with this idea of God as like a catch-all. And I think what he's saying is, listen, like there's all these things in the world that satisfy all those things. And yet I still want something else. We didn't just come up with this. Like that wasn't just something that's like a catch-all for all these desires that we have. You know, I think he says it in another book, you know, if I find in myself a desire that nothing in the...
Uh-oh. Trip?
Lost audio and you trip.
Mm-mm.
Oh, you're gone. Still gone.
You're not muted for me. I mean, your muting icon is on, but we can't hear you. Try again.
No. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, there you are.
Okay. Yeah.
Going with my Bluetooth, I could hear you fine. So
yeah,
we can hear you now. Yeah.
Yep. You're back. Second.
Now I lost you. Jesus.
Where? Where were we?
Can you hear me at all?
Yeah.
Yes.
Now I can't hear you. I could hear you before. Now you.
Oh no.
Oh, come on.
Well, as Tripp tries to spin that back up, he was bringing the point.
Talk amongst yourselves.
He was talking about the theme in Lewis, and I think it's in Mere Christianity, the quote that he's mentioning, which is, you know, if I find in me a desire that can't be fulfilled by anywhere in life, it tells me that I, or anywhere in this world, it tells me that I was made for another world. You know, it's the argument from desire that Peter Kreft, how do you say lobster, Job? Peter
Kreft.
He talks about in you know, he's talked about several times in some speeches that he's delivered. But yeah, that's a common theme in Lewis, is there's that deep longing that we can't find satisfaction for ultimately in this world, at least, you know, and he's not the only one that's felt it. It runs through poets, it runs through the Bible, and it's in so many different places, this experience that seems to be common amongst humanity.
Job, I'd like to hear your thoughts about this, because I, again, you know, have been immersed in a Christian family, Christian community my entire life. And so my familiarity with people outside Christian faith is pretty limited. So what do you, without God, without that thing that points beyond just marriage, like what do you see as the attraction to get married? How does it have meaning, or have you seen people attribute meaning to it apart from a religious context?
That's a difficult question.
Yeah.
I think it is largely cultural. I think there is an expectation. I think even when you say it's cultural, that people also would like to still be married in a beautiful building like a church. I think that's a very human thing. I mean, for me particularly, I met my wife as we were both pen pals, and we wrote letters for 8 years, and then we got married. It just seemed the next logical step. You spend so much time finding out about the other that eventually you're like, yep, I want to be with this person. I sometimes see an interesting parallel with my approach to religion, but let's not get into that. um, But yeah, there is like, why do we get married? We didn't have to. I mean, good friends of mine, they have a registered partnership. Mm-hmm. We were there to co-sign. And that was like in an office room with machine coffee, signing a paper and affirming that you've heard some clerk say some things. Hmm. And that just seemed like you're doing that to get the tax benefits, which is perfectly legal, but then you're kind of just together. There seems to be something missing. Now, I might be horribly biased, but we had an official with you know, special clothes, and there was, we had been talking to her. So this was just a person from the municipality. She'd interviewed us. What's your story? Okay, I'll make up a speech. We won't call it a sermon, but there's a speech like, okay, here are these two people and this and this and that. And then my family was there. And you get married in a municipality building. Now, the main part of the marriage for me was afterwards with my family, which my mom came from a family of 9 kids. So it's a lot of people. But that's just a big party, and your friends and family are there. But that's what I meant in my comments to the paragraph, that dimension of coming to be together before God, that's just not there. But that's very, I don't think that's strange if God doesn't exist in your frame of reference. That you don't think about that.
Yeah, I think it would be very strange if God doesn't exist in your frame of reference and you were thinking about that, but then didn't move into a way of being where you then had God in your frame of reference from then on, right? If you just temporarily said, oh, yeah, God, and then it's just not in your frame of reference anymore.
Well, and Peterson would say, now, wait just a bloody minute here. These things you're doing, these are all predicated on faith. You're making these promises to each other. You're doing this union. And of course, it's all based on the culture it grew out of. It can't be otherwise. So apart from it not being in a church, it's pretty religious. you're pretty having a lot of faith in the other and in yourself to be a certain way for a very long time. So, I think what makes it so interesting in a religious context is that you also make that promise to somebody else who's got way more, I don't know, to promise that you'll be a one flesh for the foreseeable future to the source of all being. Yeah, that's but kind of a big thing.
Yeah.
I'd be pretty nervous about that, to be honest. Hmm. I don't know how you all dealt with that. Oh boy. I had it easy. I just had to say to the other person.
Yeah. Just you didn't say it, so God doesn't care, Job. That's what we're talking
about. Yeah. I'm sure that's it. I've been my hardest.
What? But I wonder whether or not that's part of like an extra dimension of grief that Lewis was experiencing, though, because here you are, you go before God to make these promises to be with this person. And then in some sense, God takes that person away from you and leaves you by yourself. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I wonder if that's part of the betrayal that he's feeling. Right. That like, wait, I was holding up my end of the bargain here. Right. Mm-hmm. I was my part of the covenant. And then you took it away from me. Like, this wasn't, you know, my fault. Whose fault is it? Well, it's got to be the person who's in charge. Who's that? So I wonder if that's like an added dimension to like a Christian's grief in times like that. That you're asking that why that you don't have to ask if God's not there. There is no why. So why ask it?
No, there's no real point. We're just we're just participating in culture in the atheist frame. It's still beautiful and it's still worthwhile, but it's, if you dig deep, none of it makes any sense. Why would anyone do this? It's the worst deal. But we do it anyway.
Yeah, and it makes sense that marriage is declining and why people are putting it off. I mean, I have a couple of friends who are, you know, they're living together, and it's like, why get married? It just complicates things. We're, you know, we're doing everything else. Like, what's the difference? What is the difference? You know?
Yeah, and that's the annoying thing about religion. It really screws with your established worldview on loads of things. Like, I've been starting to look at marriage a whole different way. I'm like, wait, just a bloody second. But yeah, that's just how it goes. But I can perfectly see how religious people who get married, it's just, yeah, how do you even deal with it? Anyway. It's probably a whole different conversation. I think we should go to the next paragraph. If
that's all right. Okay.
Otherwise, agreed.
It's like we're almost a half an hour in. After the death of a friend years ago, I had for some time a most vivid feeling of certainty about his continued life, even his enhanced life. I have begged to be given even 100th part of the same assurance about age. There is no answer. Only the locked door, the iron curtain, the vacuum, absolute zero. Them as asks don't get. I was a fool to ask. For now, even if that assurance came, I should distrust it. I should think it a self-hypnosis induced by my own prayers. At any rate, I must keep clear of the spiritualists. I promised H I would. She knew something of those circles. My own notes are, when I pray, am I talking to myself? How can I know? This is Skeptic Lewis.
What stands out to me there is, I don't think he outright says it, but what I'm interpreting there is, well, I guess he does. When it comes to somebody that was a friend, but he wasn't intimately in love with the way he was with his wife, it was easier for him to say, well, yes, I think, you know, they're in a good place, or they, you know, I'm assured that they are somewhere else.
Mm.
And when it comes to someone who he has just loved at the deepest level that he's ever loved before, from person to person, he finds it more difficult to think the same way. And the closest person that I've lost in my life is my father. And I talked about this with Paul. You know, I felt like I lost him years before he actually left the earth, because, you know, he was taken by alcoholism. And one of the experiences that I've had as I now think about my dad after he's passed is, I almost think about him in the same way as I think about any of my other family members who aren't, like, here in the present moment with me. You know, like, my kids or my wife, they're not with me right now, but I just think about them being out there somewhere. You know, and I know that they're alive, but I think about my dad in much the same way. He's just not sitting here with me right now. I think of him as being someplace else. And so this passage in Lewis gives me a great deal of concern that when I lose someone that is, you know, my father and I were close, but we weren't deeply, you know, intimate in our relationship with each other. You know, we never had that relationship where we knew each other deeply. And so now I, you know, Lewis is scaring me. It's just like, oh my gosh, what am I going to feel like when I lose my wife, God forbid, or I lose one of my children, you know, mm-hmm. or somebody who I've been deeply close to? Is my faith that they're going to be okay or that they're going to be someplace that's all right. I don't know. What's my perception of someone who's very close to me? What's my perception of them going to be if I'm still living and they're not, you know, and that gives me great pause.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It kind of reminds me of, I have a 4-year-old who gets very attached to certain things that he just can't be without for a minute. And some things last, but then, you know, a day or two later, he's found another thing that he can't be apart from and that kind of stuff. But if he loses it, and he really, you know, and he comes to you, he's like, I can't find whatever, blankie or whatever it is. It's interesting because, you know, if you don't care about it that much, you might say, you know, don't worry, I'm sure it'll turn up, right? Like, I'm sure we'll find it. You know, you have more confidence that, like, it's around here somewhere. We're going to find it, that kind of stuff. But, like, when you're that emotionally invested in something, either a person or a thing that you're missing, it's harder to have that faith, right, that it'll turn up and that kind of stuff. Or your spouse is still there, not with you right now. And so I see. Yeah, I agree. I think that that's definitely going to be, it's definitely hard. I don't know what to say to someone like that, that's lost something that kind of deep, where you're just like, I don't even know if it's ever going to be around again, you know?
Hmm. Yeah, it's funny, as you were saying that trip, I'm like, yeah, my wife's going to turn up. I'll see her tonight.
Yeah, I had misinterpreted this paragraph. Thanks. That's better interpretation. Sorry.
Sarah, I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I don't, you know, I haven't experienced the loss of someone extremely close to me like that. I mean, grandparents is really the closest. Actually, it's going to sound really stupid, but my husband, when we were first married, he brought me this kitten, and it was like, you know, before you have your own kids, it's like pets can be children in many ways. And the next year the cat died, kind of terrible circumstances. And we had been through a lot with this cat. He'd gotten his tail frozen off, and I don't know, it's just, he was part of our early marriage and very much a product of the two of us, you know, and the cat died and I couldn't even get out of bed for like 2 days. And again, you say it's just a cat. Take that experience and multiply it by how many times thinking about losing a child. That's why, you know, I told you in the last talk, like that fear that overcomes me every so often thinking about it, knowing people that have lost children, it's just like, it's really hard to imagine getting through it. And I've seen people that have done it, and they seem to be able to continue in their faith. And so I pray and I hope that that will be the case, but it's hard. It's really hard to think about.
Mm-hmm. Has anyone here lost a parent yet?
Well, I did, but it was.
Oh, right, yeah. But you weren't.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. It wasn't immediate. It wasn't unexpected. It was a long, long loss where the person just continued to fade away from, you know, being who, you know, I knew them as a child, and I don't know.
I haven't yet, but think about it.
Yeah.
Well, in Trip, I mean, going through this miscarriage, I feel like miscarriage is such a hard deal because people don't acknowledge it. I think, at least when, you know, because we went through one a couple years ago, and it was like, we're going through all this grief, and yet, you know, I had a friend who lost a full term baby, and they had a whole funeral, and, you know, it's people just bringing meals and whatnot. And it's like you go through a miscarriage and it's almost like this thing that no one wants to talk about. It's like shameful. Yeah. And as a woman, you feel like you failed. It's like your body didn't do what it was supposed to do. And so it's all of these emotions tied up into not only, you know, the loss of a child that you never knew. So you don't have, it's different, obviously, I think, than, you know, losing a 3-year-old or a 5-year-old. You don't have those memories. And yet it's still, you feel the depth of a human being, you know. I don't know if that's kind of your experience as well.
Well, I just made that kick. Oh, sorry, Tripp. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
I was just going to add one little thought to go along with that, Sarah, where you were talking about, you know, you as the woman might feel a little bit of guilt, or, you know, the term itself that we use, miscarriage, almost makes it sound like, you know, you dropped the ball or something like
that.
It's just the term itself just kind of can easily lend somebody to taking on that that burden.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's definitely a grief there. I think that it's a grief that, again, I think that, you know, if someone really close to you dies, you feel like a part of you, like, and depending on how close you are to that person, a part of you died too, right? Like a part of you is gone and is never, like, it's never going to come back, right? There's a part of you that someone else brings out in you. And so losing a parent, losing a friend, those kind of things, losing a spouse would be really hard. It's weird with a miscarriage though, because that wasn't a person I really got to interact with. And so it's almost like this unfulfilled potential, feeling, right? It's the potential that that's what you're grieving. It's not like, I don't feel like a part of me died in the same way, that of something that was there is no longer. It's something that could have been that never will be. It's similar, but, that's kind of how I'm feeling about it. I just feel like there's this future timeline that's never going to exist anymore. That's never going to be here. And it's painful. I think it's painful in a different way than losing someone that you got to experience, who they were.
Have you guys heard, Dr. Nathan Jacobs talk about his and his wife's miscarriage? And kind of how they've been able to frame that. Do you know it well enough to talk about it, Sarah? I'm trying to grasp at the memory of it.
I only heard it once, but I mean, basically he was saying that, you know, you if you're trying to come up with the best case scenario, in a situation like miscarriage, because they had a miscarriage and then they had another child pretty quickly afterwards. And that was our case too. We ended up having our third pretty quickly after our miscarriage. And I'm probably going to butcher it, but it was basically that any scenario, of any scenario, the one where both of those lives exist is the one where the child was miscarried and the next baby was conceived. So basically, if, you know, you could say, well, it would have been better if the child had never been conceived, but yet in that sense, if you do believe in the eternality of souls, then now you actually are able to, you know, that child exists now and you'll be able to be with that child in, you know, a future life and afterlife. So that's interesting. And that's also, I think about that too, because I don't know, it's so tricky. Like my husband, his mother lost a son before him. And, you know, it was like if he had survived, Josh wouldn't exist and my kids wouldn't be here. And it's just this whole weird thing if you start going down that trail. And our third daughter, Cora, like she's such a delight. And, you know, it's hard to even really think about those things, but. Yeah. I can just hope that there's some sort of beautiful picture that's being woven that I don't know.
We have 20 minutes. potentially less for Jeff. Less, fewer. I always get them wrong. we can try another.
Yeah, let's shoot for another.
All right. Keeping promises to the dead or to anyone else is very well, but I begin to see that respect for the wishes of the dead is a trap. Yesterday, I stopped myself only in time from saying about some trifle, H wouldn't have liked that. This is unfair to the others. I should soon be using what H would have liked as an instrument of domestic tyranny, with her supposed likings becoming a thinner and thinner disguise for my own. This is such an honest and self-aware statement. How we use the dead to further our own goals. Like, oh, what would your grandfather think if you were alive to see this? And then to a degree, I of course think, well, yeah, but how is that similar from saying that God watches you? But
yeah, that that did remind me of that. My grandmother would say that to me when I was a little kid. Jesus is watching you, Jeffrey. He and wouldn't want you doing that.
Yeah.
It's certainly scared me.
Mm-hmm. And as a child, your conception of that is just all different. We had we would watch cable TV at the neighbors, and there was one of the girls from quite a conservative family, and she would watch TV from under the kitchen table, because then God couldn't see her. And then he wouldn't know that she was watching the series. It's a very literal view of God looking down. Satellite overview. Yeah.
I like that. Trip, I'm sorry. I didn't have much of a thought. You go.
I do think it's interesting. I think it's a little bit different when you're talking about, oh, God doesn't like that. Because none of us have a monopoly on what God thinks. Like, we don't have that kind of like epistemic superiority where I know what God thinks, or, I mean, I guess some people think they do, but we, like, it's harder. But like, when, if you're going to, like in Lewis's case, if he's going to say to his kids, like, oh, your mother wouldn't have liked that, there is kind of a superiority of like, I actually know better what she liked and didn't like. And so you just have to take my word for it. And so I think you're actually, even in, if you're going to use that, you're actually in more danger of using it to your own ends than God, because other people may not just go along with what you think God wants. But, you know, your children might be able to be guilted into what their dead mother, you know, might have wanted based on what their dad's saying. So I think it's a little bit different. I never even thought about that dynamic with like a surviving parent and their kids, and how would you navigate those conversations?
It is interesting now that you mention it. I mean, because let's say somebody would say, well, you know, dead person X wouldn't have liked this. And they're like, yeah, but dead. So, and I don't mean, the reason I say that is then, but instead what happens is, oh, yeah, as a sort of reverence towards the memory of that person.
Yeah. So, well, that person would be disappointed. That person would be disappointed in you, right? So it's a shaming almost.
Yeah, it's like my potential is not properly. Oh, Trip is yelling at somebody else. the right Trip?
Yeah. Yeah, someone's trying to take my room. Not let them.
Okay. Get out of here. your potential is not being aimed towards what the other person would have liked you to aim it towards. So it's kind of Petersonian in that sense. He would have said something similar.
Yeah, I think there's a way that you could in that situation shame like your kids, for instance, in a way that it's harder to do. I think with God, although you can still do it with children, I think, but I think with the mom, especially with older kids, you could do it a lot more.
I even caught myself doing it. My husband is still alive, you know, like saying, it's like a way, it's a way of deflecting responsibility. It's like, well, you know, your dad wouldn't be happy if he saw you doing this and this and this. And it's like, you know, I'm not the bad guy, he is. And I can see how you can do that.
Oh yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. Judgment by proxy.
Like, yeah, I thought about that. It's like, maybe that's not so healthy.
I'm cool, but your dad's kind of a jerk. Yeah. like maybe let's stop doing this.
Yeah, exactly. But there is a sense of like respecting things that, I mean, like even I think of I don't know, things my grandparents that have passed away, things that they would say and do, like there are things that I still to this day will think about and will adhere to because they told me these things. And I think it was always things that they did that I feel fond of, or that, you know, that bring back the memory of them, like things, ways that my grandmother would tell me to, you know, sit up straight and, you know, just different things that I loved about them. And, yeah, so I mean, I'm sure you could go either way with it, but
it is interesting to think about that we're still shaped by the people of the past.
I mean, for sure.
I'd been listening to this Audible course on existentialism, and one thing it goes into is Sartre, and he had this strong concept on how we don't shape ourselves. We don't really have that self-actualization, to a degree maybe, but we're mostly shaped by the people around us. And then there's that play, No Exit, about the hellish other people, where there's these three people in hell and they just really shape each other through all the ways that they want to perceive the other and want the other to perceive them. And it's just, humans are just the weirdest creatures. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
It's that odd mix of you know, being changed or being affected by the people around you and by the environment, but also it's the, I can't think of anything anymore without thinking of the God number one, God number two frame that Paul Vanderclay uses. Because in the Abolition of Man, it's either the second or third chapter where he just talks about, you know, we are just completely the slaves of all the generations that have come before us. You know, they've made so many decisions that have brought us to the environment and the condition that we're in. Mm-hmm. So it's both coming from above and below, you know, the way that we're being shaped. I say the above as the God number two, the actual personalities that we interact with every day. And then the below, the God number one, all of the generations that have come before us, you know, that have just come together to produce, you know, the individual that each one of us is. And so when you look at it from those two different perspectives, it's like it's the blend of those two, and then also the free will aspect that comes into it. You know, you have all of these different factors that seem to be driving, you know, we didn't choose what our personality is, but at the same time, we kind of choose what we do with that personality. Mm-hmm. And then again, we don't, because we have different random variable individuals that are thrown at us that kind of change our lives directly and indirectly. So it's like this dance that's happening all the time.
But you still need the people. If you don't have the people, you're never going to be truly human. So there's this interesting concept called language deprivation syndrome. I don't know if I've ever mentioned that. Mm-mm. Pip is busy nodding, but
I've heard of it. I've heard it. I haven't heard you talk about it, but yes, go ahead.
But it's people who get lost and they never interact with people. They never learn language because you learn language from your peers way more than you learn from your parents. And what they found is that these people were still able to learn basic things and concepts, but they couldn't develop a grammar anymore, and they couldn't relate consequences to actions, so they couldn't make causal connections. If you gave them like five pictures that tell the story of a person who goes to the market to buy some tomatoes and then comes back and something happens, they wouldn't be able to put the pictures in the right direction because they can't infer the causal connection between action and consequence. So if people around us don't form us, we don't even become really, really functioning human beings. So the world forms us and people form us. I don't know. It's so interesting. Say with my right eye, like it never developed the signal to the brain very well. So eye is fine, brain is fine. Well, the brain just never learned how to interpret that signal. So that's just never going to get any better. You need the world to shape you. We're so interesting that way.
So I think Verveke's talk, it was like the one where he talks about Christianity and agape love was so powerful, talking about how we basically love people into existence. Mm. And you bring home a slug from the hospital and turn it into a human. And that's what, Christ, in a sense, does, is he...
Oh, I love that.
He takes, takes us and through his love transforms us into people, and that it was spread throughout civilization. It was like everyone now had the opportunity to become human, even the slaves and the women and people who were considered nothing. But yeah, I mean, you see that kids that have been in orphanages in Russia and have very little, very little love and what happens to their ability to integrate and to be human. Yeah.
Yeah. That part of Verveke was just absolutely beautiful. That was just, he did an astounding job, and I haven't even watched The Meaning Crisis, but I saw that on Paul's channel and I was just like, that was saliency for me right there. Just when he was talking, I'm just like, man, he's given a better sermon than I've heard in, 75 to 80% of the Christian sermons that I've ever sat through. It was just,
I need
to
link to this.
I think it's episode 13.
Yeah.
In The Meaning Crisis.
Right. 13 or 14, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're kind of running to closing time. Jeff, how are you doing on time?
I mean, I'm doing okay. I don't know that I could go through another round of a reading, though. I probably wouldn't have enough time for us to read it and comment on it.
Yeah, neither can I, but this was just, there was so much good stuff in here. I just love how reading a couple of paragraphs of this book just brings out all these other things.
Mm-hmm. There's so much packed into them.
Mm. Well, we can call it to a stop here and try another one another time.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. Yep. We totally forgot the introduction. So, hi, I'm Job.
Job, where are you from? Michigan?
The Netherlands. You know this. Right, everybody. Great talking to you.
You too.
Bye.